Namaste, good morning. There is a nice story that I heard the other day. There was a bhakt of Krishna called Madhav Das. And everyone in the town knew his devotion to his Lord. He used to speak to Krishna all the time. Now, Madhav Das was poor and he had to keep going here and there to collect fruits, prasad to offer to Krishna at the temple. And he always wished that it was easier for him. So one day Krishna came to him and said, henceforth you will have no problem making offerings to me. So Madhav Das was very excited. So Krishna told him, follow me. And Madhav Das walked into a garden and saw fruits, an abundance of fruit trees, and started plucking away at the fruits and the flowers, and he was very happy. But little did he realize that the gardens were the palatial gardens of the king. And soon enough, the guards found this thief was stealing the king's property. So they took hold of Madhav Das and brought him before the king and said, this man has been caught stealing. Now, when the king saw that it was Madhav Das and the entire court, they were shocked. They could not believe that this gentle boy called Madhav Das could steal. It was absolutely a stunner for the court. And the king knew that he had to adhere to the laws laid down and put forward some kind of punishment. Otherwise, if he let Madhav Das go, it would set a precedent for everyone else. Now, Madhav Das was completely upset with Krishna, because he told Krishna that had I known I would get into trouble, I would have not followed you. You fooled me. And here now I am being arrested and charged with a crime because I followed you. So Madhav Das was very upset. So the king told Madhav Das, look, we all know about your love for Krishna, but this is the law of the land. I am helpless. And Madhav Das said, all right, if you wish to punish me, please do, but I insist that Krishna receives the same treatment because I obeyed him. On his orders, I walked into your grounds and started plucking the fruit and the flowers and everything. Now the king was in a dilemma, the wise king. He really didn't want to punish Madhav Das and was trying to find a most appropriate way out of this whole situation. And he thought about it. And then he said that if your condition is that I have to arrest Krishna as well, which I can certainly do because I am the king, I have my ways and means, But if that is the condition, if he is your not only your partner in crime, but the one who instigated you, and we tend to believe you because you are a known Krishna Bhakt, then I have to let you go. So the court was shocked that how was this conclusion reached by the king. And the king explained, you see, if everything belongs to Krishna, how can he steal from his own garden? And therefore, all charges must be dropped, which he is facing and his accomplice Madhav Das is facing. And when the king said this, he had this deep realization, everything is Krishna. And so he told the minister, from this day on, sign the palatial grounds, the gardens, to Krishna, and whoever wishes to come and take the fruits, take the flowers for the temple, are welcome to do so. Enlightened kingship. It is a most beautiful story, because if we remember this, nothing is truly ours. Even if we take our relationship with money, you will find that your relationship with money starts changing in light of this teaching. When you give money to someone, as Joel Goldsmith would say, firstly, it is not my money, it has come from somewhere. So even the giving is happening in the awareness that this is the Lord's money. Not I, as an individual, am giving someone else, as an individual. That is why Rameshji would say consciousness is giving to consciousness. So what happens with money, for example, is, supposing there is a loss of a large sum of money, most certainly it will hurt. Money lost is money lost. Yet, when the understanding is there that this was destined to happen, and through whom and how it happens is quite irrelevant, then all the blame and condemnation for others as well as oneself drops away. We might still take precautions not to be in the same position again. That is what the intellect, the buddhi, is about. But what happens is, the clutch, our clutch on our possessions, on our money and other objects and things, that starts releasing, the grasp gets lighter. And so we find that things are flowing. Flow to us, flow away from us, without us holding on too tightly to all this. So in that sense, if the understanding is everything is Krishna's, you might be surprised that you start becoming more generous, if you aren't already. Not only with money, with everything, with yourself, with your time, with whatever it may be, a feeling of generosity starts happening, which brings with it a tremendous lightness. This is a mail I received some months ago, and a new mail from the same person recently. The earlier mail was, I am sick and tired of life and its endless curveballs. I am planning to run away from people, city, and life. Do you suggest I make this move, or is it pointless? Am I condemned to a life of meaninglessness and lack of love no matter where I go. You see, this teaching is not going to tell you what you should do and shouldn't do. But it can light up your way so that the decision is taken in the light of understanding. We all have to face curveballs in life, some at an early age, some at a later age, some in between. For many of us, life has been more moments of pain than pleasure. The point is, this running away from life, how do we know we are guaranteed to have a better life by running away to a cave or a monastery? What guarantee is there? It reminds me of someone who's elderly, who keeps going away from this city of Mumbai to an ashram. And he told me, he said, I was under this misconception that all this trouble, of city life and people and family would be over for me when I went to the ashram. But the thrashing my ego got at this ashram, the way the people treated me when I was made to do seva, how I was handled, he said, it was like going from the frying pan into the fire. But I still go. I still go, because after all, everything is a learning. So running away is a decision one has to take for oneself. If things are unbearable, then one has to decide. But one should know that two things could happen. That the troubles we thought we left behind us will run behind us, along with us. And in fact, might run faster than us and maybe receiving us at the monastery or the cave we are running to. And therefore, this teaching, this pragmatic teaching delivered by householders to function in daily living, facing the demons of daily living, walking through life's challenges rather than away from them, with the understanding that God's will prevails and that nobody is the doer of their actions. Then one lives the life courageous and meets life head on. And then when we find that peace and tranquility and equanimity while driving through the heavy traffic of life, then one can go to the caves and the monasteries and perhaps then understand that that was all within. The peace is not found without, it is found within. I know someone who at a young age started visiting spiritual communities in India as well as abroad with the intention of spending six months, maybe more time. And invariably, I would receive an email from him after 6 months were over, 8 months were over, that he is done with the place. There are problems there, there are issues that have come up and he needs to move on. So this is a personal choice. Each person has to think for themselves. But we are here discussing this teaching today because we all live very real lives with obligations, family, friends, work, business, whatever it may be. And that is the beauty and grace of this teaching. It becomes your friend. It becomes a prism through which you start viewing the happenings in life. Am I condemned to a life of meaninglessness? It depends. What is a life of meaning and a life of meaninglessness? Are we looking for something special? Or as Rameshji would say, what is life other than the living of it? To elaborate on that, day to day, moment to moment. Why have this grand expectation of what life should be and what meaning it should have? In our building, there was this young boy who came from the village, and his job was only to be the building lift man. He would pull the door. You know, we have those grill lift doors open and shut, and greet people who came into the elevator. He was so happy to see anyone walking into the elevator, walking out. He was enjoying his job. Never once did he complain. Never once did he ask for money like many of them do. And I thought that this is enlightened living. And I asked him, I said, you are young, you know, have you thought about doing other things? And he said, no. He said, I came from the village. My uncle put me here. I'm enjoying this. And he was with this building for at least a couple of years. And then I don't know where he went, but absolutely content with what is. No demands on life, just simply being the way he was. So this is not to puncture one's ambitions or hopes of what life should be. In fact, Ramana Maharshi would say, the only purpose of this birth is to realize. Then that is the meaning of life. Which is actually the same thing. So, this meaning and meaninglessness of life needs to be really looked at. Who is the one who wants life to have meaning and purpose? Lack of love, no matter where I go. Then why not give love instead of expecting love? Why not start giving love, like Lester Levinson would say? Let your life be that journey. He would even say that if he found during the day he was a bit unfriendly or not loving towards a person, in the night he would replay that incident in his mind and imagine himself loving that person. Why not change the perspective? Give love. And how can there be really a lack of love? If one is being provided for by nature, the sun, one's breath, and so on and so forth. What is the love we find lacking? Is it a definition of what love should be like? I am not loved. Give up this demand. Love others. And you might see a very big difference, a big change taking place. As you sow, so you reap. The follow-up email which I received recently, I had a question regarding sannyas. Would it be improper for me to leave my widowed mother and everyone else and go to the mountains and spend the rest of my life striving for God? I feel stifled by society. I love my mother, but I just can't take it anymore. Do precisely that which you think and feel you should do. Now, Ramana Maharshi ran away from his family at a young age because the call to the mountain Arunachala was so strong. But there was a calling. He didn't run away aimlessly or as an escape, etc., etc. Plus, he had siblings, the family was there. Now, I don't know this person's situation and whether he is the only child, but if you love your mother and it is your mother who nurtured you and took care of you, and if the mother needs support, why not be a giver? Which I know will happen only if it's destined to happen. If one's destiny is to run away, one will run away. This teaching is not going to say what you should do. But see it objectively. What is the motivation for running away? What are the consequences? How would one feel in one's heart? And then decide, why cannot the sannyas be within? And that is why Bhagwan was never in favor of people donning the ochre robes, as he would say. Sage advice indeed. Yet, if the pull is so strong, then the decision will be made. And the consequences of that decision will have to be borne. The main point is, it is the mind which needs to be stilled, which is running away in all directions. The thinking mind, the monkey mind. Pre-pandemic, I would take short holidays to places because I had to get back to work 5 days a week, 10 a.m. to 7 p.m. So I used to plan these runaways or getaways. And it was refreshing. It cleared the headspace, so to speak, and then one came back refreshed, recharged. But thanks to my life experience, which I feel is everyone else's, and my spiritual teacher and his teaching, I did realize that peace is to be found where one's feet are. In the situations one is faced with, the circumstances one is faced with, in daily living. And I am eternally grateful for that. Next question. I came to realize that there is something that is always still, which is unaffected and untouched by actions, thought, etc. In dreaming state, the body is there in some situations or doing something, but something is there which feels like it is unaffected. I don't know how to say this in words exactly. Is that what Maharaj refers to as I amness, as a beingness? You see, this is a most beautiful awareness which comes when we are going through life's challenges, especially that there is a knowing that there's something which is unaffected. So while I'm going through the motions and the turmoil and turbulence, there's even that stillness in the background, which is aware of what I'm going through, so to speak. And that is the touchstone of awareness. That is something which quite simply happens because you see the whole, when one starts detaching from this drama of life and living and judging and condemning and hating and blaming, and when the thinking mind is no longer in that turmoil, then this disconnect happens. It happens. Now, one could call it being in the I am, one could call it witnessing. And if it happened all the time, where one was able to witness the entire flow and stream of life like this, then one would be rooted in the absolute. As Maharaj would say. Now, if we keep these labels aside, what is truly happening is that if we are, a part of us is unaffected, then we are literally watching the movie on the screen of life. And that is a most beautiful place to be at. You see, being in the I am is a very natural state. You cannot not be in the I am. Otherwise, you would be dead. But you are functioning as the ego. I am so and so. Functionality has to happen. We cannot live as zombies. So, abiding in being, as Maharaj would say, that is what starts happening. Because we are always abiding in becoming, abiding in the dead past, abiding in an imaginary future, and so on and so forth. And when we find that part, as you say, which is unaffected, then we are abiding in that being. As Maharaj would say, let's say there's an object, there's a telescope. Let's say you're seeing a planet through a telescope. The planet is the object, the telescope is consciousness, and the absolute is witnessing that consciousness. Witnessing of the consciousness is happening to the absolute. Yet it boils down to one word, which is witnessing. So it's very nice if this happens. At the Thursday meditation, someone else mentioned something similar to this, and it's a free sample from God, as Rameshji would say. Okay, this is about someone who listened to an interview and it brought on a volley of tears at the end when there was silence. Why did this happen? I asked myself. Had I suddenly invested my imaginary self in the happenings around me? Just now, listening to a 4-hour podcast between two teachers, I again had to pause and let the tears have their way. And this was during an intense non-dual, non-doer exchange on the attributes of consciousness. What do you think is happening here? If this becomes a regular response, one's deeper understanding stands to revert back to me and you. Is this dualism at its best? Firstly, I don't know enough, but tears happen. Now, there are various reasons why one could find oneself crying a lot, especially when one is on this journey. let's not forget that tears are a form of cleansing. That's the first thing. Now, supposing one is starting to see the futility of one's past thinking, past ways of being, tears start arising when revelations come. Or it could be that the ego is now on shaky ground. I have seen it with someone just before their awakening, they went through hell. Any small thing and they would start crying. They were with a spiritual master, with him, but the triggers were so minuscule and there would be tears and tears and tears because the last defenses of the ego were being broken down. So it was quite cathartic for this lady. And then after that, her awakening happened. Another way to look at it is that this, you could call it the area of wisdom, is cleansing away the tears, dropping away. So, why this particular sentence? Had I suddenly invested my imaginary self in the happenings around me? Who is saying this? It is the same me, the same ego is saying, had I invested my imaginary self in the happenings around me? Who cares, as Rameshji would say? The ego is trying to figure everything out. It wants answers. Why not go with the flow? Why wonder, my God, what will happen? Am I stuck in dualism? This is all the voice in the head, you see. This is not the voice of the silence. This is the voice in the head. Why am I crying? Why are tears this thing? Why is this? Why is that? Is it my imaginary self? Is it this? Is it that? What if I get caught in dualism? Allow the energy. Allow the teachings to do their work. Nowhere in your letter have you said you are unhappy that tears are coming. Nowhere has it said that it is a form of suffering. Maybe it is the death of the me that is bringing tears up. The death of the me and my story. Then aren't they good tears? I remember I was at someone's birthday who's a guru, and so his followers were giving him gifts one by one. And one very sweet lady knelt down and she had this nice gift envelope with obviously money in it. And when she offered it, she was crying profusely. And so he told her and everyone there, he said, now only she will know if these are tears of gratitude or she's crying because she had to part with so much money. All right. I'm going to break this long message up in parts. I am finding it really difficult to overcome the idea that there is some experience or object to be attained permanently on the outside. But there isn't. So that's answered. No matter how hard I try, whether it be on seeking sincerely and accepting all these changing states of mind, I am not able to cross a certain threshold. That is because crossing that threshold is not in our control. Yet we may try as much as possible. The results are God's will. The body idea, the body attachment, and moha seem to have pierced life with their hand claws. Beautifully said, that's for everyone. But at least you are aware of it and you are voicing it in a very beautiful way. I find myself lost and lonely. Then you have many for company. None truly there for me, for an unconditional love and emotional support. Everyone seems to be loaded with their own ideas, thoughts, and expectations, which naturally get bombarded and exercised on me. Join the gang. And so too, you have your own ideas, thoughts, and emotions, which perhaps you are bombarding on others. This creates a bit of rupture, friction with most people. Yes, it would. If you thought you were being bombarded by people doing things, it would create ruptures. But if you accepted that everyone is entitled to their opinions based on their conditioning, the way God made them, just like you, where would this question be of bombardment and opinions? Bombardment can only be perceived by a me. Blaming others. I have never been in any relationship. You have. Your relationship with yourself. Nor do I wish to hunt for a true partner without my parents' knowledge. Fair enough. The point is that God has blessed with all necessities fulfilled and a good profession. Isn't that fantastic? There are many who have lost their jobs in the pandemic. Glad to know that you have received this blessing. Even there's blessings of meditation and spiritual practices. Even better, you're doubly blessed, which is rare. Let unbridled gratitude arise for these blessings. But I feel life to be like slogging, dead from the inside, but living on the outside as the individual entity. Actually, it becomes the other way around. It, so to speak, becomes dead to the outside and living in the inside. Dead to the outside means dead to all perceptions of this good happened to me, this bad happened to me, and all these polaric opposites and dualities of life. They start kind of getting evened out. One starts walking the middle path. With the understanding, as Maharaj said, that between the banks of pleasure and pain, my life flows. Even the spiritual practice of japa has come to a standstill. I feel that a powerful realized being like Sri Sri Anandmayi Ma or Sri Ramana Maharshi, etc., can instantly uplift me from this state with a powerful realization and stabilize mind into true nature if I were to be worthy enough. Most certainly they can, and leave it to them. Or at least help in finding my real life partner. If that were the way out, I don't think these two are connected. I mean, where is the connection between finding a life partner and getting realization under Anandmayi Ma and Ramana Maharshi? However, I don't know where to go, how to find a powerful realized master or true partner. I feel I have committed a big sin in my past life to have either neglected the words and guidance of such a master. Hence, I have taken birth in this age where we have no idea of such a master. Well, if you say you feel you have committed a sin, what can you do? The past is gone. Why rationalize it by saying, maybe I did this in a past life and therefore I have not come across a realized master or a true partner? Perhaps you can get realized living with your partner. That might happen. I don't know what is the right thing to do here. Whether it's all about my patience to wait for such a master, or that I need to hunt for a spiritually elevated true partner. Even the who am I question appears, stills the mind temporarily, but dies away soon as the thinking mind takes over. I feel life to be stuck and stagnant due to these things. I am not able to overcome body attachments and seeking on outside. You see, this frustration is very relatable for many people at different levels, perhaps based on their own experience, what has been written here. But if we are waiting for something to happen, then so be it. But then we have to let go of all these expectations and know that if something is meant to happen, it will happen. If it is not meant to, it won't. You see, the ego does not like to hear this, because it means I am not in control. If you feel you're not blessed with a realized master like Ramana Maharshi, Ananmayima, etc., etc., you have to ask yourself, what is all this dialogue? What is it about? What can I do in this life? If I'm drawn to a particular master living or no more in the body, can I immerse myself more in their teachings? Can I apply their teachings to daily living? Why not take that approach? Why all this conceptualization? That is what the mind does. It creates a labyrinth. And then the ego starts going round and round in that labyrinth, round and round, round and round, round and round. Because now it knows this is my comfort zone. These are my walls. I recognize these walls. You know, in the Chartres Cathedral in Paris, there's a labyrinth. A definition of labyrinth is the longest possible walk in the smallest possible space. So you will find like that particular labyrinth is a circle, and you had to walk and walk and walk and walk and walk. That was a spiritual practice, because the position of that labyrinth, walking in that labyrinth, was awaking certain energies. And those masters who built that cathedral knew what they were doing. Even the colors of the stained glass windows of that cathedral were not an artist's fancy. Each color, the light coming through the stained glass window, impacting the body of the human walking the labyrinth, was playing a role in awakening energies. Now, you see, in that labyrinth, there was no path which led you out of the labyrinth. You had to jump across a couple of blocks. I know all this because I was there. I did it. That is called the leap of faith, according to me. This labyrinth of life, the labyrinth of daily living, needs acceptance of God's will and openness. As Joel Goldsmith says, receptivity and openness, because the thinking mind, the ego, tries to shut down everything. It needs an openness. It needs a faith that whatever truly happens is God's will. This leap of faith is the hardest part. This absolute surrender to the process of life and living. And then one may find that one is just going on and on and on, round and round and round in circles, trying to find a way out with a preconceived notion that this one could give me enlightenment, that one could do something, all in the mind, based on some future happening. A possible partner will come and everything will be solved. Living in an imaginary future. And that is why this teaching brings you down right now to this moment and faith in this moment as bringing about whatever is meant to be brought about according to God's will or the cosmic law, as Rameshji would say. That leap of faith has to happen. One cannot do it. If it is meant to happen, it will happen. But yet, the ego could try and cooperate. Even that, of course, will happen if it's meant to happen. But that is why one is drawn to spiritual teachings in the first place. Let it not become a punishment, please. All right. If anyone would like to ask something or share something, they are welcome to do so now. I wanted to add here something which Joel Goldsmith had said, which I began by. He said, imagine if there's an object which we really love. Now, firstly, that object came into our consciousness. And where from did it come into our consciousness? What he would call the infinite invisible. From somewhere this object manifested, but we get fixated on the object. Shouldn't there be gratitude and reverence for that from which the object came? Therefore, which would be more important, so to speak, the object or that from which it came? Yes, Imran.
Sir, namaskar. Namaskar, everyone. At first, gratitude only for all the teaching you have done for us. And today's my question is, does law of attraction works as it mentioned in the book, The Secret by Rhonda Byrne? So if someone wants something to manifest in their life, they need to think about the thing and then visualize about the thing that as if it is already achieved and do the action as the opportunity comes and get it. So here it seems destiny can be changed by using law of attraction. And many people already acknowledged it, that they have benefited by using the technique. So my understanding is all this technique is already scripted as a part of destiny, and our ego minds takes the credit of doership. Just I want to know you throw some light on this understanding.
Thank Actually, you, that part is irrelevant, Imran. The most important point is, does the law of attraction work for you? That is it. Your answer should be yes or no. Why ask somebody else about the veracity of the law of attraction? If you have tried it, and if it works for you, then you know it works. It's as simple as that.
So here the destiny part is then that everything is predestined. Then can somebody change it by using law of attraction? This is my question.
Well,
what is your understanding?
If they were destined to get a Mercedes Benz and part of that destiny was to implement the law of attraction, then that would happen.
Right.
The point is, get the Mercedes Benz without the law of attraction.
yes. I mean, already scripted. The technique is already scripted if it is going to happen.
You see, we have to be careful, Imran, because the problem with this is we tend to want to attract to ourselves objects, a big house, a beautiful car, etc. Nothing wrong in that. But if our focal point becomes that rather than peace of mind, we might find ourselves very frustrated if these techniques to attract objects is not working for us. You see, and this teaching is all about peace of mind in daily living. So that is why I say we should not try to ride two horses at the same time. We should not try to, as my friend Rohit would say, we should not try to cross-pollinate two ideas, two concepts, two teachings. But the focal point of Advaita teachings, based on what I am speaking about, what my teachers have spoken about, the crux is peace of mind in daily living. The crux is not manifesting objects, etc., etc., etc. So the one could say it's a very different dimension and aspect both these teachings are discussing. And I would rather say that what this teaching is about is perhaps the law of distraction. Anything that takes us away from peace of mind is a distraction, and that has to be looked at and observed and understood in the light of clarity and understanding. So these are different things.
Right.
The law of attraction is different. This is different. And
yeah,
I think you need to test both in your own experience. And perhaps you will find peace of mind through Advaita, and you'll find yourself attracting things through the law of attraction. That is the best possible scenario.
Sir, my interest is not on law of attraction. It's because many people just using this technique. So I need to understand this so that I can teach people
or share
my understanding. So you don't go this. Everything is doership only.
But until you try it, you won't know it.
Yes.
And it is doership. There's nothing wrong in that. If it's a technique. Now, for example, there are people who practice Kriya Yoga, let's say. You could say that is doership, but that is a yogic technique. In life, we have to do things, right? And we pick and choose that which appeals to us. So I hope that answers your question.
A lot of things, sir.
Thank you. Yes, Abhishek.
Good morning, Gautam, sir.
Morning.
How are you?
I'm good. How are you doing?
Good, sir. Good. Very good. Just a thought arose in my mind that whatever we are asking, whatever we are listening to you, it's just because we have caught this one more day from some divine power, without which this couldn't be possible. So I think we should be grateful for every morning to that power, which gave us this opportunity on this new day, to which we can ask questions and to which we can gather this learning. So sense of gratitude.
I couldn't agree with you more, actually, because, you know, even I used to take it for granted. I started enjoying going to the Sunday satsangs of my guru. It became an enjoyment. But later I realized that, you know, when I started visiting him, he was 83 and I was with him till 92. It was only in the later years that so much gratitude arose, that this opportunity was there. Because I thought to myself, you know, when I met him, I was 30. And when he passed on, I was 39 and a half or something. And I thought that my first 30 years made sense only in the light of these 9 years. It was like a jigsaw puzzle, which all the pieces started coming together, you know, something which seemed so random, events in life and situations and challenges, so disconnected, so abrupt, so intense. And this kind of wrapped it up so beautifully that I realized that each Sunday, and he used to give talks every day, after all, he was retired. I could go only on Sundays on account of work. There was much gratitude because for two reasons. One was, you see, he kept saying the same thing again and again. There was nothing new. And people would ask, they would ask him, you know, we come to you, you say the same bloody thing again and again. And he said that it is like listening to your favorite song. You can never get tired of listening to it again and again. One. And two is, you see, this crust of conditioning is so strong around the ego that it needs constant hammering to break it. So there is a reason for the repetition. It is meant to be that way. And so I realized that nothing but gratitude could arise at this gift that consciousness, the source, has brought me by grace to wisdom teachings which resonate with me, because they make sense of life which otherwise would not make sense.
That's so true, sir.
How is your father doing?
Not really good. The treatment is still ongoing, but doctor says that not showing any positive sign, I think so. But one thing which I have seen in his attitude, that lately he started saying that I have an inner feeling I'll get well.
Sorry?
So, lately, my father has told me that he has an inner feeling that he'll get well. So that's a positive attitude. I think he's looking forward to it.
And how are you handling it?
Honestly speaking, it's just happening that I tell him every time that all will be well, and I try pacifying myself that nothing was in my hand, honestly speaking. So I'm not being a blabber mouth, but I honestly feel that it wasn't in anybody's control, and I try to find peace in that.
Yes.
Because if I don't find peace in that, then, you know, I'll ruin many things like my work. And then if I am with him, then I won't give him good energies as well. I won't be able to focus on other things also. So this thing is truly happening by itself, that I'm finding peace through it. Of course, there is a hurt. There is a sense of this thing that he's going through all these pains and all. But there's nothing truly I can do about it, right?
Except.
Exactly.
No, except be present and offer one's presence.
Exactly.
That is the most beautiful gift we have, you know. That is the only doing needed to be done.
Exactly. So last week we went to the doctor, and doctor said that looks like the disease is still there, and it's been almost a month or so that we went for chemo and it was not showing any signs. But then there wasn't any questions from my side that why. You're getting my point, Gautam sir. So that was creating a lot of psychological suffering, right?
Yes.
So I did not ask the question why it's not going or why it's not happening. I said, okay, if you suggest any other sort of treatment, we'll go through it and we'll see. That's it. That was from my side. And I told the same to my father as well. There is nothing to worry. We'll try our best.
Beautiful. Thank you.
Thank you for the teaching. And I would like to add one more thing, that I was listening to Ramesh sir's YouTube videos. He was an amazing person. And I really wanted to ask you in one line, how was the experience to be with him? He was such a lenient master, or such a funny master, the way he spoke to people and the way he used to give that jokes and examples to everyone. Everybody used to laugh, you know. Must be an amazing person to be with, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And so real and down to earth, you see. As I say, I was very fortunate to have a kurta pajama, white kurta pajama clad grandpa who became this master, whose ashram was his living room. It was so real, so approachable, accessible. And, you know, it's incredible. Like I saw on YouTube, someone posted a clip of a German retreat, where perhaps it was the last day, and one participant told him that, you know, I think all you've spoken about all these days is utter nonsense. And he replied saying, I couldn't agree with you more. Except perhaps that you'll go away with a diminished sense of personal doership. You see, because the ego it's most likely find it nonsense, because it's taking away all that the ego stands for. That is the beauty of this teaching. So thank you. Thanks for sharing.
Thank you, Gautam sir.
Yes, Holger.
Namaste, Gautam.
Namaste.
I have nothing specific on my mind. I just wanted to say thank you. And it's just so beautiful, all the light that you share, and just gratitude.
Thank you.
Thank you.
One last question. Yes, Poonam.
Hello, Gautamji.
Hello.
Thank you. Immense gratitude to you for everything. So, Gautamji, the thing that you just spoke about, the dream thing. So I had this in my mind, which I wanted to ask you today. And amazingly, you shared the same thing about the dream. Actually, I started taking life like as a dreamer, not the dream character. So it is helping me a lot when I am doing all my daily activities. So I just wanted to ask you, like the teaching, like please guide me with the teaching that like when the ego or when the dream character starts getting involved in the story of life, so how do you cut that involvement? Like how do you do it, like practically? Like there are a lot of problems come, and like even every word that you speak or every word somebody else speaks or the interactions and everything, like sometimes you're not happy with what you say or you do, or sometimes, and you know that you're not the doer actually. So, and if you go into the doership, then it breaks your connection with the source. Then you like tend to get disconnected from your stillness, from your source, because you went into a doership and you thought that you said that or somebody else said that, or you tend to get involved. So I just need your guidance, Gautamji, that how do we break that? Like how practically, how do we do it? Like break that involvement as not as a dream character, but see yourself as a dreamer. Like, because the dream thing has really helped me, like daily living. Like when I see the life as a dream, because a dream is not in your control. You what you're saying in your dream or what the other person is saying or anything that is happening in the dream, events, whatever is happening, is not in your control. It is all happening. So that's the same way the life is. But then how do we break that involvement?
Okay, one sec. If you are dreaming,
yeah,
can the dreamed character in the dream come out of the dream? It's not possible.
No, not possible, right? Yeah. So that intellectual understanding is there, that nothing is in my control. Even the word, even now what we are having conversation is not in my control or anybody's control.
Can you choose when the dream ends? You can't choose it.
No.
The dreamed character cannot choose any of this.
Right. Right.
So who is the dream character saying, I know I'm the dreamer? The dreamed character is certainly not the dreamer.
Right.
The right. whole point is, Poonam, forget about all this. We are living what we realize is the living dream of life. Why do we call it the living dream? Because it is so thin. Something important yesterday is no longer important today. It all disappears in our deep sleep. And we get this sense that what is this, you know? It's so unreal, intangible. But yet, I have to live my life in this dream. I have to live as Poonam.
Right.
I have to face situations. I have to deal with people. Sometimes the understanding is there. Many times it's not there. What can I do about it?
Right. Now,
the point is, Poonam did not choose to come across this teaching. This teaching came across Poonam. And that leap of faith, Poonam has to leave it to the teaching, leave it to the divine wisdom, that when I am meant to get the understanding in a certain situation, it will come. When it's not meant to come, it won't come. And Poonam starts living her life with this effortless ease, without trying to control, oh, I'm involved in this dream now. Oh, I'm not involved. Oh, I'm involved. Now let the teaching operate in the background. you will find you get involved in certain situations and others you don't.
Right.
You will find that when there's involvement, sometimes you come out of it, sometimes you don't. This right. is all a part of the process. But Poonam has to see, what was I before being exposed to the teaching? And how am I now? Is there any difference there? Do I feel certainly I've touched some level of peace? Then Poonam knows if that is so, she has to leave it to the source, to the higher power, to bring in the light of understanding whenever it is needed. It is not in Poonam's control. Yet Poonam continues to live the living dream of life day by day to the best of her ability, what she feels her best is, knowing that whatever happens is God's will.
Right. Correct. So if the thought happens that, oh my God, again, I'm getting involved in the story, then you will pull yourself out of it. Or if it doesn't happen, it's
just... You don't pull yourself out of it. That's the point. It
right.
is the understanding which pulls you out of it.
Right. Hmm.
And more importantly, when you wake up from the dream, all the characters disappear.
Mm.
Not only you, but the others, all the dreamed characters disappear and vanish. And then right. you know that all that was unreal. You see, what tends to happen is the focus on me becomes so strong.
Mm.
Oh, I was involved in this. I did this in that situation. I was not involved. That is all the dialogue of the me.
Mm.
But when witnessing starts happening, that this life is a dream. Everyone is reacting based on their script. Things are happening, including myself. It brings a kind of witnessing of the dream. That is what brings one out of the dream.
Mm.
Not the individual character called Poonam, which now wants to control the dream and say, I should be not involved. I should this, I should that. That also needs to be witnessed. Because ultimately, when you wake up from a dream, all of it is irrelevant.
Right.
As they say, all the pieces on the chessboard of life have now been packed away and are put in the drawer.
Right. And it was not even like nothing was in your control or nothing. It just what was happening was happening. Nothing was in your control, actually.
Yes.
It was just events happening on this.
That's it. Screen.
Yeah. And Gautam, one more thing I wanted to ask. In your talks, you always said that be dead while living. So that sentence really appeals me, but I don't know how to bring it into our life.
Can we keep it for the next Sunday?
Okay, sure, God. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Poonam. I'm glad because, you know, all this investigating shows a lot of sincerity.
Thank you.
I was telling somebody, or I don't know if I mentioned it last Sunday, it was a very heavy monsoon many, many years ago. And it was a Sunday morning. And I was so accustomed to going to my teacher's home for satsang that I was at a loose end. I was like, what do I sit and do at home now? And it's pouring and pouring and pouring. And so I decided to take the car. Luckily, I had a car and I drove down in a very heavy rain, a little bit of flooding, but not much in this side of town. And only three people showed up for the satsang, two foreigners and myself. And it was completely, a shock because usually there was a crowd of 20, 30, 40 people. And so Ramneshji came out and he was on his rocking chair and then the noise of rain was very strong. So he called us closer, you know, and we sat near him around his feet, three of us. And he pointed out the window at the heavy rain and dark skies. And then he looked at us. And he said, you three have come. And this is the test of the sincere seeker. That you really want that teaching so strongly that you come, you know, you try your best to come and you come. And I did confess to him, I said, you know, honestly, I was more privileged because I have a car. I had nothing to do. So I don't know if it was really a test of the sincere seeker or for my own entertainment I've come. And he said, that's what you think, you see. So the teaching pulls one like a magnet. And when you find, if you find that a lot of your life, a lot of the events in your day, you've started watching through this angle, then you know that you have been really sucked into this most glorious teaching. Thank you.